This is Marcy Schwartz and Howard Braun interviewing Dr. Leonard Schwartz for the Oral History Project for NCJW Pittsburgh Section, October 1st. Dr. Schwartz, could you please give me your father and mother's full names?
Yeah, my father was Harry Morris Schwartz, and my mother was Jeannette, J-E-A-N-N-E-T-T-E. Harris Schwartz, her middle name, her maiden name. It's a middle name too, isn't it? It's Harris.
The atmosphere in your home life, in the early years, you said you were raised in the Lower Hill. Mm-hmm. Could you describe some of the community life, the cultural life, disciplines in the house, anything you'd like to comment on that?
I was, as you know, an only child, and I think I had a relatively stable family life, except for my father's alcoholism, which was a daily encounter and disturbed that stability, you know, on a regular basis. But at age six, was going to the butcher and getting 3 second cut veal chops. I paid the rent and began to work to earn money as early as I can remember. You know, at six or seven, I was picking up pieces of scrap iron to sell to the junk dealer. And it was very early in my life that the work ethic was an early issue. I was selling newspapers, you know, and carrying the paper, doing all that kind of stuff, and selling football souvenirs at the Pitt games on Saturday. Cultural life. You mean like, what was the neighborhood like? What did we do as a neighbor? We had, on Little Davenport Street, where I lived many years, I would say the ratio of Gentiles to Jews to blacks would have been 1 to 10 to 3. Something like that. So we're very much closeness, despite the variegatedness of the ethnic groups represented there. So it wasn't unusual for me to have dinner in my black boyfriend's house, nor for him to have it in mine. And the gangs, much of the interactional life for me was part of a gang. I always belonged to a gang.
What kind of gang?
Well, they weren't always up to that much good, I can tell you. But it was a cohesive force. I mean, I think strong sense of identity came on with anybody. We but friends were a terrifically important part of my life. In summer months, my mother would see me in the morning and then 11 o'clock at night. That was it. I was gone. And most of the time, playing sports. And that was one of the functions of gangs. You know, we played football and baseball, softball on the street, and the other games that kids play, like 30 scatter, release, and all kinds of other games that we played at night. Nothing wrong with all that stuff. It was good stuff. We were aggressive children, and so fighting and things of that sort, you know, fist fights were not unknown. And I came home with my share of bruises. My mother was not overprotective of me in any way. I don't know how well that fits the pattern, but as an only child, my mother really felt she had to pay very little attention to me. She knew that I could take care of myself, and I took care of much of what went on in the home too. and I did lots of chores and stuff like that. My mother could depend upon me to work. Work for money, work for the home, work. The use of energy to accomplish tasks.
This was partially as a result of your father's...
I think so. That's a good question. I think, you know, you can make a very good case for a kind of an aged Oedipus complex. You know, it's supposed to be over by the time you're six. But mine continued on as I was clearly the preferred male in that house. I have to tell you that, and I don't know if it's of interest in this kind of interview, but my mother was not an affectionate person. And so, Oedipus Schmedipus, we were kind of good pals when we were on good terms. But I think I got some kind of a physical blow in my direction every day of my life for at least 10 years. My mother didn't have time to sit and psychoanalyze me, which might have had something to do with my becoming a psychoanalyst.
Did your mom work outside of the house?
She did it from a very early age. My father had a tough time earning a living. And my mother, I remember, she first became a corsetier. She sold corsets and fitted them and knew all about that business and had other jobs, one after the other. But I remember staying with my bubby, my grandmother on my mother's side, for a couple of years and looking out the window for my mother. I had theorized in another written work that my own farsightedness came from the need to look for the distant mother, and that probably helped shape the globe of the eye. That's a whole theoretical thing I won't bother with.
That's interesting.
Nearsighted kids, I have also discovered, but much more depth, that nearsighted kids oftentimes are held very close and tactile to the mother for more years than are typical. And they develop a long eyeball, which is nearsighted in relation to that. You see sometimes the first sibling in a family is the most nearsighted because the mother holds that kid closest and lets the subsequent kids go a little further. Then when she gets into menopause, she has the last kid, she brings that kid close to herself again. That kid becomes myopic again. We've studied hundreds of sib ships to see if that's true.
Okay, that's fascinating.
I do too. It's been fascinating me for 35 years.
Thank you, Tim. You had mentioned the schools that you went to, but were there any influences from those schools, from a teacher or?
Mm-hmm. From those schools, do.
You're talking about elementary and high school and junior high school.
Yeah, I was influenced by all of my teachers. I had great respect for all of them. Mostly because they delivered a commodity that had increasing value as the years passed. I knew from a very early age that my job was to learn things. And learning things, I gave up fiction very early in life, as a matter of fact, and began to read non-fiction as early as I can remember. Little books on science that I would get at the Carnegie Library on Wiley Avenue. I became, in a sense, and still am to some extent, prejudiced against those who read fiction. Yeah, thought that there's too much work to be done in this life, too much knowledge to be absorbed, simply enjoy the fun of fiction.
Did you get that sense from your parents or from teachers or from perhaps aunts and uncles, or you think that was just...
Aunts and uncles didn't figure in any of this. Except Uncle Harry. I had a couple of Uncle Harrys. my Aunt Rose, my mother's sister's husband, Harry Slocken, his name was. And he was a lawyer, had been a lawyer. Wasn't any longer. He was an insurance man like my dad was. How that happened, I can't tell you. Slawkin. And he was a World War I veteran. And now I got an idea about Jewish stuff. He taught me to read Hebrew, Yiddish, you know. He taught me at a very early age. I would go down, I lived on Forsyth Street, off Miller Street, and I would go down to his house, which was on the corner of Forsyth and Vine Street. That's in the middle of the lower hill. And I would do this reading stuff, and sure enough, when I got things right, a penny would fall from heaven, and he would reward me that way. But I wasn't supposed to look up to see where it was coming from. I was that little and impressionable.
Did he teach you from the Hebrew book or Yiddish book?
I can't tell you. I think, since it had the little pencil on, you know, mm-hmm. I think it was Hebrew. Mm-hmm.
Can you still read Hebrew?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I haven't done it, but those are things I can't forget, like it's, you know, it's like riding a bike. I'm no speed demon, but I cannot.
Once you got into adolescent, how did you spend your time during your adolescent years in terms of recreation or community?
Sports, and the burgeoning interest in girlfriends, of whom I remember three or four who were classmates of mine who lived on my street. And there was a lot of on my street. When I say my street, I don't know what street I'm talking about because there were 12 or 15 streets. You know, we moved so many times. A flash that came through my head then was Marion Brown, who was one of my first girlfriends. And that was on Webster Avenue. She was the brightest girl in class. And I remember play ball with her brothers. And it was one date, I think. I had my first date with her, which had something to do with some high school function, prom, whatever. When I went to Shenley, I lived on Camp Street in Harrogate. That's living in the upper part of Harrogate Street now. We lived in five or six different homes in that area. I told you last week, I met Millie when I was about 15 or 16. And it was not long before we were kind of steady and everybody knew it.
And that just continued until you married?
Yeah, it continued through the war, and we were very close before, and I spent a lot of time in her house, and once was kicked out by her father, I remember. Before I entered the service, and it was almost we wrote to each other for 3 years during the war. And it was almost a foregone conclusion that we married soon after I got home.
What effect did the service of World War II have on your life?
Grew up, I think a growth spurt, you might say. I was given lots of responsibility in the situation where I was on Saipan. I spent most of the time with the Steeple Battalion, as I told you. But I was made I was in charge of all the Japanese labor on Saipan. And I was only, 19 years old. And I'm not sure why they selected me for that anymore. I'm not sure why you guys selected me for this. But that was fun. And I would meet with the admiral. I was just a second-class seaman. I would meet with the admiral of the island every day, and he would say, "Schwartz, how are things going?" And I would tell him. And when it came time to pay them, we paid them the American dollars. I 45 strapped in my hip, would sit there and pay 14,000 or 15,000 Japanese men.
They were prisoners?
Well, they weren't really prisoners. I guess the whole island was in a sense, prisoner in a sense. We didn't lock them up anywhere. They lived in their own huts, but they were not allowed to do anything unless we told them what to do. The island was secured in that sense. The natives became part of our responsibility. We had problems too with them, and they would, for example, get down into the lower holds of the ships and drink beer if it was a beer ship, and sometimes drink themselves into oblivion, and so things had to be done. But that was a very important 3 years of my life, and I learned how to get along with men that you lived with in a Quonset hut for that length of time, and there was a lot of fun, and some danger.
Huh? Main seaman set.
No, I became a bosun. Bosun's mate finally.
Okay, mate bosun.
Yeah, all the people in stevedore battalions got that rating. That's what it's all about, rigging and stuff like that, which is clearly what bosun is supposed to do.
You were first class?
No, second.
You remained second?
Second class bosun.
Second class bosun.
At the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. And then you came back and started at the University of Pittsburgh.
Started again. I'd started to Pitt before I went to the service and had 1 year in pre-med. We went into the service on October or something of 1943.
You had indicated that you weren't sure what really led you into medicine. You know, as a freshman going into Pitt, how did you select pre-med?
First of all, I couldn't think of anything else that sort of struck me. And my father, who had wanted me to be a rabbi or a baseball player, about equally, I think, was very much taken by our family doctor, and thought that profession was really, you know, marvelous. And that might have had some influence. Maybe stuff I saw en passant in high school, articles I would read in magazines about surgeons and medicine men generally, may have caught my interest. But as I said, I never thought of it as an occupation, a sense of earning a living. But it looked like, I was proven right about that. It looked like a kind of a profession that had an open end, and that is that learning, that old issue again. I could expect that I would have to continue to learn for a lifetime as a physician. And that appealed to me, and it always has.
Do you remember the name of the family doctor?
Herzstein. Dr. Herzstein. I remember him looking at me when they thought I had scarlet fever.
H-E-R-T.
Yeah.
S-T-E-I-N.
R-T-Z. S-T-E-I-N. And I remember members looking at me and saying, yes, he's elected. You know, that meant I had the disease. And I was always impressed by him, the little magical things he did with the opening that bag. And it was as though he was some kind of a special kind of intelligence that was once useful in show business at that time.
Excuse me, you had mentioned that your father was a religious, and yet you say he wanted you to be a rabbi or a baseball player. I can understand baseball player, but where did rabbi come from?
I think my father had read a number of literary works by either famous rabbis or by other clergy, not necessarily Jewish, and even though he was not a believer, he thought they were brilliant. My father was a strange combination of characters. He, for example, would rhapsodize over the Saturday afternoon opera on radio. And that was an absolute must. But he would faint practically from the emotionality of the music. And I think that's where I developed some of my liking for music, although we were a musical family. We would sometimes sing, in the kitchen.
Really?
Mm-hmm. My mother had a wonderful voice, and my dad could sing well, too, and I told you last week about our taking piano lessons at the same time.
How long did those piano lessons last?
Not long. Maybe 6 months, but I never... You know, I tried to play Fairlise because she was playing it, Mama, and I can still play it. It's interesting that I don't play it well. I don't play it like Ashkenazi or something, but I still have a gefil for the piano. The word gefil has an importance in my...
What?
Gefil. The German word, Gefühl, G-E-F-U-Umlaut-H-L. One of my very good friends, years and years ago, before he left for Israel, where he has lived ever since, used to talk about the chemische Gefühl, for example. And I got to thinking about that myself in terms of trying to get the feeling of a number of different intellectual areas, like getting a feeling for a language, getting a feel for French or for German, for even Japanese, tackled Russian too. I have one child, my elder daughter, who made 800 on all the language tests. You know, she made a perfect score and could teach herself Swahili in 3 weeks, you know, that kind of stuff. So language was important to me in the various argots of science. Medicine became as much a language to me as anything else. And it is very much a language. You know, you get into medicine, you really feel when you're talking to a colleague, you start talking a different language. And I could rattle off a paragraph and other people would not know what we're talking about. And yet it's a highly effective, efficient language in terms of transmission of information per unit phony. Those have been important things. I think that was transmitted to me by both my mother and her that magical ability she had in speaking fluent Yiddish that I never could quite understand how she could do that. I never learned it from her. And my father, who, while he didn't have that, had other languages that came from his reading. And don't forget, he went to fourth grade.
When you entered Pitt...
I have a feeling I'm not answering any of these questions.
You are answering
You are, very well. When you went to Pitt, did you receive any honorariums or awards or scholarships, grants, anything like that?
I got a scholarship to some other college, Allegheny College, when I was in Shenley, which I couldn't take. It would have cost me more to go to out of town, so I went to Pitt. But at Pitt, I was in the honorary, a lot of honorary stuff, like honorary biological fraternity. I'm a member of AOA, which is the honorary medical fraternity. I won prizes even as a kid, like for writing poems. I don't know if you remember, if they had it when you went to school. Every year they had something about safety. Kids had to write essays or poems or whatever about safety. I would always win every year. Either I wrote a poem or I wrote an essay about something, and it was because the kids in my class were so non-literary that I always couldn't lose.
Do you remember any lines or anything like that?
Oh, no. No. I still write poems. And I've thought of writing a poem about exercise physiology. There would be a collection of humorous poems to try to teach physiology in that format. That is, the thought of teaching through humor and rhyme. Like even limerick. I've written limericks about exercise galore. Some of them are dirty, so I haven't passed them around, but most of them aren't.
Can you give us one?
Can I give you one? I have stacks of them upstairs, but I don't think I can remember one now. They're very easy. Five-liners are very easy to write, you know. Edward Lear was one of my gods, and you know, he wrote limericks like nobody's business. What else?
Millie, was she educated in Pittsburgh as well?
Yeah, Millie's father did not believe that his daughters, there were three, should go to old-fashioned school, and didn't believe that they should go to college. Millie, I think, won some sort of a scholarship and went to work. And it was a good thing she did in a way, because that supported us through the early years of our marriage. She has gone back to Pitt, I think, within a couple of credits of a bachelor's degree, mostly in art history and that sort of thing. And she plans to go back and finish that now that she's going to go back and sit down with her businesses. Now, she's a fiction reader.
Congratulations.
I've never been able to convert her to the wonders of nonfiction.
What did you set up home when you first got married? Where did you live in the city?
We lived in her mother's house, against my best judgment, but because of the finances, my going to school and all that, we lived on Black Street, where her mother and father, and later her other sister lived. All of us lived in the same house. We lived in the attic, in a little two-room attic, which was just wonderful. We had lots of friends there and all the time. We had lots of fun in that house.
B-L-A-C, King Street?
Uh-huh, in East End. Yeah, just a block away from Stanley Avenue. And those were good years. Our lives, by the way, were affected tremendously by our best friends, who remain our best friends, and have for these almost 50 years now.
Would you give us their names?
Sure. with pleasure. His name is Saul Chosky, and his wife is my first cousin. She's daughter of my mother's sister, Molly.
What's your name?
Gene.
Oh, Gene.
Gene Chosky, C-H-O-S-K-Y. She was the smartest kid in high school. And she and Millie were, as I said last week, best friends. And we, the four of us, have gone on, 50 vacations, maybe 100 vacations over these last couple of years. And we eat out together sometimes 2, 3, 4 times. We leave each other's house every week. So it's just the most marvelous relationship because it doesn't have all the disadvantages, glaring ones, I might say, family life, and all the best parts of friendship. It's kind of a mix.